Little session here. My name is John Weber, Principal Consulting Engineer for CDW. I've been an MVP for a couple of years. Been involved in LCS, Link, OCS, you name it. If it's a communication server, since about 2002. Today we're going to be talking about planning considerations for edge, meetings, geographically dispersed edges, why you might want to think about it, why you might want to do it, what might force you into that decision of making the choices, that kind of thing. My intent is not to show exactly how things are working or maybe how a cert works or anything like that, because it's already been done. It's out there publicly available if you choose to take a look at it. And what I would like to do is bring my real-world experience of having done who knows how many deployments, because that's all I do is link deployments, into this session and help you understand why we made choices that we made. And towards the end, I've got some real-world examples of what we've deployed. And the intent is, again, to maybe raise more questions than I ask or than I answer. I find that, and we'll get into it in just a second, that the people that plan out in extreme detail are successful on the first time through. The people who don't, they call us, and I'm in there going, That's missing. What, you know, why don't you have this over here? That kind of thing. It becomes very difficult to recover from it, because as you'll see, as you get one element put into it, adding an element later sometimes and almost always forces you to the top of the stack and replan everything back out again. So that's where we're at. Here's our agenda. I start every project, and gentlemen in the front row over here on my right, we had a conversation about a month ago, and we spent the first 2 hours talking nothing but business requirements. What does the business require? I don't see starting a project without doing this, because how can you define a set of technical answers to business requirements you haven't defined yet? Typically, that requires stakeholders to be in the session that can answer the question of, we want mobility. We want external users. We need dial-in conferencing. We want to have multiple solutions for if a thing goes down, what happens? And we can't afford this thing to go down, so that'd be HA kind of thing. So the planning considerations that go into that, we're going to touch on policies a little bit. I think policies are very important. I've got a customer now that made a set of choices, and now they're in the meeting context. They're facing the outcome of that choice. And they made those choices because they didn't want to buy licensing. And so you go into the conferencing policy and you make the global two users, which means they can't really do anything other than with two users. And then anybody who wants to organize a conference bigger than that, you have a different policy for them. So when you make choices like that, it drives customer behavior down the road. And if you're not aware of them, if you haven't planned for them properly, you're then driving maybe help desk calls that your help desk people maybe can't answer or aren't qualified to answer. And then it comes back up to the people who put it together, and we start running around in circles again. We're then going to put up the basics, and we're going to start with a single internal server. And then we're going to add dial-in conferencing. Then we're going to add another site. Then we're going to add edges to it. And then we're going to add a second edge to it. And at each step along the way, I'll be trying to highlight what are the considerations and why you would want to do it and where you would want to be paying attention to it. Objectives. I just did it. I just defined a conference. Link thinks almost everything is a conference. So if I've got two people IMing, Link really thinks that's a conference, because I can add a third person to it and make it an official, you know, conference. Understanding the edge impact. Edges have a large impact on your environment, and the edge is a required element for things like mobility. If you want the full Link 2013 client to operate, you're going to need an edge server. Is everybody here already have edge deployed and using mobility? So not everyone? People are thinking about it? Excellent. Understanding the site impact. I've got clients with really, really bad WAN links. And if you stack up 10 or 15 users, all of them on HD, which takes about a mega a user, on a 5 meg circuit, and they all join the conference at the same time, in comes the call, hey, our call quality is horrible. people are dropping off. There's lots of jitter and there's screaming in the background. Well, it's because they overloaded their WAN link. So let's take a look at a WAN link in terms of your link deployment. And there's another planning consideration that you might need to address, either in terms of cutting down the bandwidth available, restricting the clients to maybe VGA instead of HD kind of thing, all right? Then the conference impact on the network DNS and access modality. I've already covered that to some extent. And then up in the corner up here, I come up with policies again. Policies, if you take nothing more away from this, then let's plan the policies before we start. Let's get the business requirements put in place and how the policies might affect us and allow us to implement what we want to implement, then I've done my job today. All right, business requirements. This is the typical list that I see when I walk in the door and we start talking about business requirements. They want to be virtualized. They want to have HA. They want to have DR. They typically think that DR and HA are the same thing when they're not. HA is defined as if a single component fails, there's something else there to take its place. If you got load balancers, for instance, you might want to have a hot pair. If you've got a front-end server, you might want to consider having a pool. But then you run into the documentation stack that says, well, a pool is really three, but we can get by with two. And if you're going to do that, now we have to have SQL. And to get SQL to fail over automatically, you really need to have three of them. And it kind of cascades through this little planning cycle. It's sometimes when I run into these projects, the people have already bought hardware or they've already allocated VM space. I show up and everything gets thrown up in the air, and you know, it's a 52-card pickup at that point. So I'm constantly after our pre-sales guys. We need to be a bit more generic and not urge these people to buy things prior to let's getting the planning done. So it's often a juggling act on my part. If you're all working internally, I'm thinking maybe you have an opportunity to have that discussion first before you start engaging somebody or putting together an internal team to do that work. DR is, I have two sites, I'm pool paired, and a drunk drives into the telephone pole, takes out the transformer, and my whole site just went dark. What do I got to do to come out of that? How does that affect my conferencing when it might be active conferences taking place? How do I get them to maybe reconnect? What's my process going to be? So there's another juggling act, right? Back up to VM. Everybody knows that a VM is going to have roughly half of the capacity of a physical box. I think I was talking to somebody yesterday that they came out with the virtualization guidance for 2013 just yesterday. So I haven't seen it yet, so there, I might be a little bit off on my estimates here. But basically 7,500 users per physical machine, cut all those numbers in half for a virtualized environment. And then experience tells me that I can go further down on RAM and CPU cycles and still support maybe 500 to 1,000 users pretty successfully on a single virtualized box. So there becomes a planning consideration of up and down through this stack of what I need to provide, how I want to do it, what my platform's going to look like, how I need to have it for HA, how I want to have it for DR, and then we start talking about the bottom one, which is external access, which throws everything back up in the air again. A single edge with two pools, everybody has to come to one pool and then get proxied over. Something has to authenticate the user in. I have never, ever installed a director. I just don't see a need for it. Director in 2013 has been really deprecated down, although it's still allowed for, but I've personally never done it. Compliance and archiving, I've got customers that have a need for that. It's a legal requirement. They must archive everything. As a piece to that is the monitoring server, where if you've got any kind of enterprise voice rolled out, if you've got wireless involved, or if you've got maybe WAN links involved, I would highly urge you to put monitoring in place. So you can take a look at, even if it's just peer-to-peer activity, link client, internal with no access edge. So you can see what maybe where your problems lie, and the monitoring server reports will tell you that. All right. Wow, that was ridiculous. Okay, pushed the wrong button. Policy concerns. Policy concerns are basically this list right here. Who can get in? Who can do what? Who can record? Who can share? who can do maybe a PowerPoint presentation. At what level do you want to allow that? Meaning that maybe you've got a group of users that really need to organize big meetings. Maybe they're executive admins for the CXO level, and you want to be able to allow them to put together maybe a quarterly meeting with 500 people. Well, I just described a scenario that link out of the box by documentation doesn't really support on a single pool. You might want to consider putting up a pool just for those people so they can organize those bigger meetings. While you already got maybe 50, 60 other small meetings running, maybe that one big meeting might impact our flow back and forth. And so there's yet another little planning consideration. Meeting size user training is listed for me on a policy concern. I think it's the next slide, because of this little matrix up here. I threw this together just for demonstration purposes. It's not a recommended thing or not. But the bottom line is I can put together a set of policies that cut you down to being able to do one thing. So in the planning processes of how I want to deliver my meetings, we need to be considering the fact that there's a global that everybody's going to get no matter what. And that might be, in the case of that one I outlined, they cut it down to two people with nothing so they can IM only. No video, no audio, no nothing. And their plan was, as they rolled it out and got users trained, they were going to turn that up a little bit. But they were never going above two users in a conference because they don't have the licensing for it. Everybody in here have an Enterprise Plus Cal? Across the board? Got 1,000 users, got 1,000 licenses, right? Not everybody gets that. Whether you need to have that Enterprise Cal license to do conferencing. So as you work your way through this, does your help desk know about this matrix? Does your help desk know how to determine what the user has for rights? So if the user's having trouble and they call in and say, I can't, I'm in a meeting with Mary and I can't drag Bob into it. So you go through a whole bunch of troubleshooting, we can't make it work, we can't get tier two involved, only to find out that they've been impacted by the global, which is only two people, and they can't do anything with it by design. So if you don't consider these kind of interactions ahead of time, how do you know how to train your users? How do you know how to train your admins or maybe your help desk to help support this system in a more seamless fashion? All right, here's the organization policy and the participant policy. These are the default settings. And I'm going to put this up here merely for conversation purposes of this is the kind of stuff that you need to think about inside of a meeting policy that's going to allow you to do data sharing. This button right there where it says 250, if you leave that on the global and you haven't arranged for your full licensing, everybody's going to come in the door at 250 user meetings. Everybody, because this is global, out of the box by default. So that might not be meeting your licensing requirements. It might blow your entire structure out. How many people use SharePoint? Are you aware of the fact that when you do a meeting inside of Outlook and you click on the make me a link meeting, make it recurring, give me 52 one a week, I just made 52 of these things in link. Tends to blow SharePoint out a little bit too, because if you haven't arranged your drive space correctly, as I just made 52 meetings. Or worse yet, maybe you just made a daily meeting, 365, and sent it to everybody. So there's more of this little back and forth here at every step of the way. There's more of this back and forth. What do I need to consider? The other thing I look at is, it's the fifth or sixth item down. This little puppy right here says enable audio video. Guess what audio video requires again? Enterprise Cal again. For compliance, this little piece right here is pretty important. I've had customers click on that and then forget they clicked on it. And they want to know why. Well, that they're recording it outside my environment. How are they managing that? And you do some troubleshooting, you find out that they got that little button clicked, which is allowing anybody who joins the conference to record locally on their machine if they got a link client. Or if they've even come in with a LWA. The rest of this stuff is really pretty straightforward. Typically, if you're running conferences on the inside, Microsoft's findings are that somewhere in the neighborhood of 4 to 7, maybe 5 to 8, is the common meeting size. Link will run, if you're running 8 cores, 32 gigs on a standard edition, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 or 400 of those concurrently pretty easily. If you run, again, if you run into virtualization, it's, those numbers are going to start going down a bit. And at the same time, it'll support somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,000 or 3,000 IAM sessions at the same time. But if you let it sit there and don't think it through, you could easily go, geez, I just invited the all address list to my meeting, and everybody gets flooded with it. Something to consider. Participant policy is another place where you can turn off the ability to participate in the full meeting functions. Again, my client has got a global of two, and everything's turned off. So somebody who has a higher level collaboration policy can invite the other people to the conference, and the other people can't share. They don't get to be a presenter. They can't take control. And here comes the help desk call. Why can't I do this? Well, we shuffled back through the documentation and said, this is what you chose. This is how you did it. This is what we implemented. And this is why it's not working the way you expect it to. You'll need to change your policies, but you'll need to buy more licenses to support it. So everything chains back up, and everything chains back down comes back down the hill. Planning considerations, I think I've already touched on most of these. Domain users internal get handled one way. A domain user external with an edge server is essentially a full Link client, and they are essentially a full participant in everything that Link has to offer. I am my home plate out of Chicago. I work out of Portland, Oregon in my basement. I got a 100-foot commute to include getting a cup of coffee in the morning. And I log in across an edge server, and I'm a full, I have everything. I have full enterprise voice. If you call my number and I'm not there, it rings my cell phone, it rings me, it rings my mobile. It's a wonderful piece of gear, but you need to think it through for bandwidth. Maybe you might need to think it through for, I've got a bunch of people I want to assign a PBX number to. How many channels of a SIP trunk am I going to need? So we've got, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 or 600 people on our system, and probably 3/4 of them are fully remote because we only have the one server stack in Chicago. How many SIP trunks do we need concurrent to support all those Erlang B users? Everybody run through an Erlang B on their environment if they're doing voice? And you come up with, oh, well, we need to have so many channels and so many ports. That's an important consideration for if that's the route you're going. And I bring that up because to get dial-in conferencing to work, we need to have something like that. And you need to be thinking these little elements through before you start, or you'll be calling up IntelliPeer or your favorite SIP provider saying, you know, I really need to have maybe a burstable SIP channel instead of just a static 10 that I ordered. And maybe that might affect how many channels you ordered on your gateway. Or you'll be calling back, and you'll be constantly be chasing it. Or but maybe you could plan it out ahead of time and have maybe a level set. This is what we're going to aim for. This is what we're going to initially purchase, and we'll need to manage our usage into it. Federated users, Microsoft's federated to me. I'm federated to them kind of thing. I swear, Sean, you're federated to me. So he's a federated user to me. So we can do things like everything that I can do out of my conferencing policy. A learning tool on this is that if he organizes the conference, my participation will be generated by his conference policy, because I'll be joining the conference out of his server, not the other way around. Yes?
One of the best things that we found for federation, actually, is when we work with partners or offshore development groups, if there's some requirement for collaboration with Link, instead of trying to set them up with accounts on our system or set them up with anything, we just say, you can federate with us, and if you don't have a Link system, you can buy an Office 365 account, and we'll federate with you via that, but we'll federate with you, and it keeps all the issues of, oh, this client doesn't work, or I end up supporting the person who's supposed to be our vendor, which I did a lot of. Now they have their own setup.
Oh, good. Scenarios, thank you, Sean. I mentioned anonymous users on our scenarios. There is a corner case for for Office 2013 Pro Plus, where typically the install gets done and a Link client gets deployed to the workstation. I send them a meeting invite. They click on the meeting invite. The meeting invite's interpreted as a Link file or a Link link. They hit our web conferencing meet, and off they go launching the Link client, which they don't have a login for, and so they fail to log in. They can't join my conference. The way around that Wow, did they not put that slide in there? Well, that's disturbing. The way around that, which we might run into a little bit later, is to add a question equals question mark equals SL1. And I probably have that wrong, and I'm sure I have a slide for it, which forces the use of Link Web Access client, which will bring you up on Safari, I think Chrome, IE for sure, and Firefox will download the client and allow them to join as a full member into the meeting, which handles the no link client present scenario. Everybody here do PowerPoint presentations, of which I obviously hate to do. Link PowerPoint presentations are now run off web application server, which will require you to have some sort of load balancer maybe or a reverse proxy put in place to allow that traffic to come in from the outside world so you can present to the outside world at the same time. It's also going to force you to have it, period. Otherwise, in Link 2013, when you go to present a PowerPoint, it's going to say, uh-oh, too bad for you. Another little point that you might want to consider, bandwidth consumption. I already mentioned it one time. HD consumes a meg a user. If we start talking about having a mega user, and you start talking about having the first server or the first speaker and the last active speaker already being transmitted, or if you're doing multi-stream videos, and we've got five or six people in a conference, you know, you've got a 5 meg link, and it's already 50% consumed with backup traffic, file transfers, and what have you, we're gonna blow something up if we start going across a WAN link that's small like that. It happens more often than you would think. All right, so let's build this thing from a basic series. This right here is just a single server, and there's the clients that can connect to it. I do have a small error in here. Anybody can see it? The colors on the WAS server are wrong. Okay. This is supposed to be red, and it comes up orange for some reason. This is a standard edition server with a WAS so we can do PowerPoint. And this is representative of a very simple system with everything being active for users. We can have a link client, we can have a WAS client, we can get Macs and Apples into it, and we can have link phones, not like a VVX, but something that can log into Link, okay? That's a Cat5 connection, can join these conferences also, which you'll have to do a little bit of EV configuration to make that work. You'll have to maybe assign a common area usage phone, but they'll be able to pick up the phone, dial it, and join the conference because they'll be connected at the extension level. Here we've got adding a dial-in, and we've got a gateway, an IP-PBX, a connection out to the CO, and we have our devices here. Notice that here's another error. I'm listing like an iPad or a Windows phone. Mistakenly, without an Edge, you cannot join those. Okay. I also list them over here, mistakenly, as I learned just yesterday. I swear that I've done it. What I have done is I can join a 2010 mobile client, but not a 2013 mobile client. 2010 mobile client still has an internal only option. The 2013 requires an outside connection. You can be on the inside on your wireless, but it needs to look like it's coming in from the outside, so it must be attaching to that outside IP address. We don't really have any considerations here for meeting, conferencing, and planning, with the exception of this line right here. Lots of people bring in like a SIP trunk, or maybe they bridge over from their existing PBX, which would be this line down here, and they never consider how many concurrent calls they're doing. Where if they got a T1 line, or maybe this is a TDM connection here, and they want to go, oh, we want to have 50 doggone people in this thing, but they've only got one T1 provision. Well, we just came to a screeching halt at 23 people, and they don't think that through until number 24 calls and can't get in. Let's add a second site. So a second site adds a couple of complexities for us. We still have the same stuff over here with all the same considerations. But now we've added a WAN link that I've mentioned several times. A WAN link can be lots of things. It can be a direct piece of wire run across the street, piece of Cat5, you know, less than 300 meters or 100 meters long kind of thing. It could be a WAN link based on wireless. It could be a lot of things. But let's talk about these two firewalls here. In 100% of my deployments, if we've got an issue with a second site or clients joining or things not working right, 100% of the time there's something wrong with the firewall or there's something wrong with the network itself. maybe somebody set up a VLAN that's blocking ports, doesn't have the right kind of bandwidth allocated to it. Networks and firewalls, networks and firewalls, networks and firewalls. The documentation stack for this piece right here is essentially going to say, here's my client-server ports, here's my client ports, here's my client-to-client ports, and they all need to be paid attention to. Network people like to open up these LAN links, the MPLS links, to very specific sets of ports. I'm doing a project out of California where they swear up and down there's no firewalls on their MPLS. I shipped them off the documentation and said, then all these ports need to get checked before you go back to the network guys, because if all these ports aren't open from the pool servers to the pool servers, they can't possibly talk successfully to each other. And they looked at, what, 5 pages of ports and kind of refused to do it. And I said, well, then you can't go back to the network team and say, all this stuff doesn't work, and ask them to blindly check. You're going to have to do something here. They figured out a PowerShell script that banged through it at the NetStat level and proved that a bunch of stuff wasn't open, even though the network guys swore there was no firewalls on their MPLS links. Adding an edge. Adding an edge adds another set of firewalls. This is the recommended methodology, by the way. Notice that I got a firewall here and a firewall there, two leg in the DMZ. This edge server, not the reverse proxy here, but the edge server here, absolutely requires two subnets. Anybody here try to deploy a link edge server with only one subnet? Two NICs, but one subnet? Good. Doesn't work. It looks like it ought to. It might actually get a couple packets through, but in general, the server is not going to know where to put traffic because it sees the same subnet on both. We absolutely have to have an outside gateway facing the outside world, not the inside world, which means that the static routes on this piece right here will also need to know about all the client subnets and all possible server connections that are going to exist on the second site. Otherwise, that edge server won't be able to talk directly over, which it needs to do. That might force firewall changes on these two firewalls. It'll definitely force firewall changes here, but it won't affect firewall changes up the top. Again, if you don't plan this stuff out ahead of time, it can just be a real bag of worms to figure out where am I failing at? And if you don't have a predicted outcome based on, a correct structure to start off with, if you can't predict what the outcome of the test needs to be, you can't really find where the problem is. This WAN link right here might become more critical in this environment where we added an edge to it, because the edge is going to handle all my internal traffic talking to everybody on the outside. Phone calls, data collaboration, screen shares, all that stuff that might suck up some serious bandwidth might now be running all the way across here and then out that way, while all this traffic here needs to be going also, and you might wonder where your 5 meg link just went. All right? What the heck is it doing there? Yesterday it was in a different spot. This is the SL equals one comment that I made about the what I do is for every meeting that I make, I try to modify, I do a little cut and paste to modify, so that if I don't know who's actually getting the meeting invite, I dump another link into it and then tell them about it right up in here in some text that says, hey, if you don't have a link client with a login, click on the second link so you can get into the meeting. All right, what's impacted by edge? This is going to be a broken record for those of us who understand what a broken record is. Everybody understand how an LP record works? Is that just a trivia question? Everybody knows that's a concentric string all the way in? So my kids didn't know that. Subnets, subnets, subnets. Firewalls, firewalls, firewall switches. The only one that really doesn't match up here is DHCP. DHCP has a couple of minor impacts, mostly on when you're deploying the server. If you deploy the server with active NICs marked off as registering DNS and DHCP, and you don't specifically set them before you put them up on the network as here's a fixed address, they might be picking up a DHCP address from somewhere in the DMZ. If you have the environment that has a full domain out there with a bunch of servers and some monitoring and management, that might be an impact. But if it is, we need to pay attention to it. DNS, the edge, and I'll show you an example here in a bit. My DNS chart for internal and external runs about 200 lines down the page. for a full distributed geographic edge deployment with two full pools and double edges. So it's just an example of, as I work my way down through the stack for planning, 200 lines of DNS entries, or at least considerations for IPs and FQDNs, you can't juggle this in your head. It absolutely has to hit paper, or in my case, an Excel spreadsheet. Firewalls, I think we've already covered. In some cases, if you're running a single firewall with, some people construct ASAs with, they got a leg coming out this way and they come out of the edge server and they come right back to the same firewall. I don't understand how they're doing it myself, but some people put two firewalls in place. There's an insurance company in Portland, Oregon, who's got five firewalls in place between the internet and the client itself. And they got various zones, and it was a real mess. But proper planning considerations, and then hand it off to their network and security team and let them kind of puzzle it through. But for troubleshooting purposes, if we didn't know what address was needed to talk to what address and how that pathing went through, it was a real bear to troubleshoot why a client wouldn't connect from the outside world when they wanted it to. HLB starts to hit this right here. Anybody done a full HLB deployment using full HLB for the edge, or have they done DNSLB? I know you have. All right, DNSLB is our friend. Seriously. I would never, since 2010, I don't think I've ever done a full edge pool of using HLB fully. I've done nothing but DNSLB. It makes it so easy for the people on the inside to manage and handle, because I've lost a whole layer of HLB. On the other hand, HLB, as of November of 2012, when TMG was no longer sold, because TMG used to be my reverse proxy of choice. I could virtualize it, I could lay them up on AA, I could WNLB them, I could just bring them up online, and it did everything I wanted to do, including content redirects. Now I need to handle that at an HLB layer, or maybe I'm going to do IIS ARR. F5s will do it, Barracudas will do it, KEMPs will do it. There's lots of devices that will do it, and an HLB by definition is a reverse proxy, but it adds a layer. We've now taken a physical device and kind of gone into this logical construction, and I'm using different constructs to achieve my goal. It's another layer of consideration and planning. Everybody have HLB in their network already? Of some description? Maybe we need to route it, maybe we need to path it, maybe we need to have a different license on it to get the functionality out of it we want. Okay, security, firewalls. I see people put an edge server out as a peer of a firewall, so that they're not adding the public addresses. They got the public address right on the edge server. Please don't do that. I'm not aware of any instances of an edge server being broken through by that methodology, but I think it's just asking for trouble to do that, and it's not a recommended solution. I'm sure there's some script kiddie out there with way more time on their hands than I have that if you've got enough at risk, they're willing to come in and try it. Reverse proxy, I just got done covering. Certificates, I like GoDaddy, I like DigiCert, I like Komodo, I like lots of people, but you're gonna get involved with certs, publicly facing certs with an edge server, whether you want to or not. And then that same cert level needs to come into the external web services on your front ends, because you've got external traffic coming in that's landing on those front ends. Everybody use wildcards here, or are we trying to talk big long lists of names? I'm sorry? Oddly enough, wildcards work really well across the board. I'm sorry?
Using wildcard for OS.
It works as a blind second for office web apps.
Yeah.
It'll work.
You can
use them across the board.
Yeah, well, and we're using for some of our deployments as well.
Yeah, it becomes a financial consideration for planning. Mm-hmm. If you've got a wild card that might cost you, let's say, $500 for a cert,
yeah,
the issuing company might not be too wild about you putting that one wildcard cert on like 9 or 10 or 12, 15 different servers. They'd like to charge you for all of them. It becomes an honor system kind of thing. And there's also the consideration of maybe I've only got three names for my whole deployment, that the cost consideration would generate I need individual FQDNs on the cert rather than pay the bigger cost. It becomes a, to me, let's think about it ahead of time, let's map it out, see what it is, and then the customer, you in this case, gets to go back to the cert provider and say, well, maybe I want to pay the $500 for this because it's only $495 for all the rest of these names here for the same period of time kind of thing. I like to give the customer all the options rather than just one. It's their deployment in the end. Oh, one last thing. SBC for voice, we're talking about doing dial-in conferencing. We're talking about putting it in a subset of enterprise voice. How many people use an SBC? Why did you choose an SBC? Right? Do you know that the SIP trunk provider will typically SBC their end and they'll count on you to do something on your own side? Yeah. Audio codes, Dialogic, who'd you use? I'm sorry? Oh, Sonos, yeah. They're fully qualified. If you're going to put an SBC in, please go to the OIP, Open Interoperability Program, and choose somebody who is certified. When you start choosing non-certified providers, Cox Networks in California, they're going to want to bring their own piece of gear in. It's not certified. They've never done it before. And you'll chew up more hours trying to figure out why the refers don't work or why the calls don't work or why the link server can't talk to the gateway to start off with when it's IP to IP, then maybe your project will support. And I speak from personal experience on that one. All right, where to start with Edge? When I'm planning an Edge server out, because I need to get meetings and conferences into this thing, I always start with just one server. And I sit there with a whiteboard, which I don't have available to me today, and I draw my little pretty lines. I got an IP coming in, I have my Edge server, and I draw out one. And I make sure I know what I'm doing with one. And then if I'm going to want HA, I then add HA to it. So now I got a second server. Well, how does that change things? Well, now I got DNSLB or possibly an HA pair of HLBs sitting there. How does that change my IP layout? Well, I just went from, in the case of a double-edged DNSLB, I just laid out six IP addresses instead of nine for a HLB layout on two servers. I can probably get by with maybe two servers, two IPs if I do all my ports stacking up on one IP kind of thing. There's a couple of different pieces you're going to go back and forth on with that one. Once you get all that figured out, and you know that you, from your planning, your business requirements, and maybe looking at your WAN links, you can say, well, I'm going to need to have a second site over here. My WAN link stinks. I'm not going to be able to afford to get a better one. Well, I got 100 users over there, and I know they're all going to be wanting to talk to each other. I'm going to put another site up there so I can keep that traffic over there, and I'll live with one or two meetings going across it if I really need to. Maybe you might want to put a different edge there. So if mothership goes down, these second set of users can still operate. Well, how does that change things? Well, now I've just doubled up all my IP addresses. I've got all my simple URLs that might need to change. I'm going to need another subdomain on my SIP domain so I can have full edge capabilities. Or maybe I'm going to allow my SIP traffic and my call setups to come across site number one, which I'll show you in just a second, but my media flow is going across the edges. And that would require a couple more DNS entries, a little bit more planning. Point being, you start adding edge pools. We need to start thinking about all the planning from the top of the stack back down through it again. All right, we'll add a second site to this. It's starting to look a little bit more like an eye chart, but here we've got full client loads, inside, outside, inside, inside, full here, PSTN. To me, the biggest issue on this one is how these PSTN calls get across. A little bit blasé on my part for the double edges because I've done a bunch of them. The SIP traffic flow generally would come in through site one, hit my server here, get authenticated here, and then start talking directly to the pool over here. If we start talking stun ice turn, because that internal user is trying to join an outside conference, he's going to get from his pool over here up across the WAN link, out to this edge. This edge will start trading stun ice turn SPNs, I think they're referred to as. So you get the candidate layout. My client and my company will see your set of addresses, and it'll start preferring that set of addresses out there for the call setup. If I'm a member of this pool, once the call setup occurs, we'll start talking out for media flow out this server here. That makes sense to everybody? If it doesn't, and you don't plan it ahead of time, you'll be wondering where your calls are going. You'll wonder where my meeting content went. So plan it out ahead of time, and literally, and you'll see it here in a minute, it runs down the Excel sheet quite a ways. You can also run this running two complete SIP domains, so domain number 1.com, domain number 2.com kind of thing. And in that scenario, this site here would have its own federation route, would have its own MRAS route. All right, some real world. This is a New York and New Jersey firm, and they're literally maybe 10 miles apart, and they've got a DS3 between the two of them, which is pretty slick. We chose to do SIP A, B, and WC on both edge pools, knowing full well that any of the four possible DNSLB entries for the SIP could land on any one of the four servers. And they accepted that during planning because that piece right there was so huge. At the time I was there doing the planning with them, they were running less than 5% concurrency. Why they were paying for DS3, I have no idea. But we had plenty of bandwidth. We also had plenty of bandwidth for their projected, there's about 1,000 users here and about 600 here of their maximum, even if they loaded everybody up onto a full HD conference all at the same time, they weren't going to blow that WAN link out. So that was acceptable to them. This is a corner case, and I chose it because it's so grossly overpopulated on this piece right here, on that WAN link. I hardly ever see anybody with that kind of WAN link speed, except for maybe they're doing SAN replication between two states and they got a backhaul channel, but that's all they've got on that thing, because their SAN backups are running constantly. We've also on this one, we had a couple SBAs that I'm not gonna talk about right at the moment, an MP only for some FXS and another four-digit subsite. As a side note, the really interesting part to this project was allowing for this whole structure up here to lose its SIP trunks and gateways and be able to go out one of the two SBAs and make phone calls. That was kind of fun. Yeah, in this case, yes. Well, each pool, this pool here and this pool here, in the topology builder, both get their own set of external web references. So that this is all complete DNSLB. The web traffic for each front-end pool, of course, is behind an HLB, Kemp's in this case. SIP, because there's two servers edge out here, and there's two servers edge out here, there's four entries for each SIP domain, or for each SIP record. There's four entries for AV, and there's four entries for WC. The SIP call setup will land on one of the four servers, come into their respective next hop pool, get authenticated in, then get shoveled over to the next, to wherever they need to go. And they accepted that traffic. If you're in New York and you create a meeting and I'm joining it, we don't know which one of the four SIPs we're gonna land on, but I do know which of the two WCs I'm gonna land on for our conferencing. And then if we ever do AV on that same conference, I know where I'm gonna be originating from, because it'll be pool specific at that point. So we've got SIP equal across the board, AV and WC separated out. We did not do simple URLs in this case because at the admin level they didn't want to mess with it. I had already lost them when we got to this point. Here is that actual environment, one site, in real life. And now you can see where maybe we start talking about having a DNS chart and an FQDN IP chart with an external chart and an internal chart before you start. Just the server build chart in my as-builts is quite extensive. By the time we get done with all the little things I want to do for each operating system per server, per role, now I'm doing a SQL server. I mean, by the time you get done stacking all this stuff up, it can be quite large. Notice that we've got a separate file server down here. We were using DFS for that. A little side note. Three SQLs, three of these. The planning for this, just to allow this one site to work, maybe a day and a half or two. Not too bad. This is full load, double gateway. The gateway configurations for conferencing are such that they can drop a SIP trunk, of which they've got four, one for each gateway. And we're pretty confident, although we haven't fully done a full matrix test yet, we can drop three of the four SIP trunk channels and still make inside and outside calls. And we should be able, based on the PSTN flows, be able to operate any of the PSTN usages to any of the one of the four gateways based on PSTN usage and waiting and which order you've got them set in, of which pool they go out. And I mention that because for conferencing, people come in with LWA, can hit that little button that says call me, and this customer wanted to guarantee that their vendor customers and their partners could always be called. All right, here's another project I did downtown Portland with a data center. Their IT headquarters is in Portland, Oregon. Their primary data center is in Frankfurt, Germany, and they have a huge nexus of users, a couple thousand, in South Africa. And the WAN link between South Africa and their MPLS and then Germany, so they get that little kind of visual ring going on and everybody's connecting to it. That WAN link that comes off of that MPLS and goes to South Africa stunk. It was guaranteed to have 10 megs or something like that, and there'd be days we'd be looking at it and maybe sunspot activity, we'd be getting less than 2K throughput. It's like, so part of the planning considerations was we need to have a second pool. There's enough users down there that are using South African contacts, maybe they're up into the Congo or something, that traffic needed to be constrained down to that one pool. Yes?
Why did Nemo just help right there?
It's South Africa. That was the answer I was given. Apparently, maybe I'm spoiled because I live in North America where we can just order up bandwidth. Apparently down there, the bandwidth that they can order, because they're in Johannesburg, ordering the bandwidth, no big deal. Getting it hauled up the length of Africa or across the Atlantic or any other out of their area becomes the issue. So it's not necessarily their local bandwidth, which inside the data center will look really good. However they were getting it there. There's days when I swear they were bouncing it off Mars or something. I have no idea how they were provisioned. Yeah, once you get there, it was fine. I think it was the getting there part. Yes?
When did you do this?
It's ongoing.
Oh, because I know them and we're federated with them.
Yeah.
They're telling me how much great progress they're making. They didn't tell me they brought someone in to help.
Sorry.
So no wonder they're leapfrogging us.
Ha, 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 ha. We're also operating a back channel. VLAN out, pathed out, static routed out. We're running back channels between all the link components so that we're not forcing the traffic to go across the VPN links. In this particular case here, to answer your other question, we are not running SIP through here. We're running all the SIP through Germany, living with the TCP ACNAC scenarios of it might take a while to do the call setup, but then once they get there, they have their own AV and WC edge. So on the DNS planning and chart side, the DNS entry for SIP for their domain does not exist on this edge right here. It's there if we want it, so we can just quickly add it. The zone's already sitting on a 5-minute TTL. So if Frankfurt goes down, their manual plan is to assign SIP to here and come back up to them. And then they'll figure out what happened in Frankfurt. So, but that was after we got done talking for about a week and a half, going back and forth through all these various little scenarios, that was the methodology they chose. I'm certain they have money to do something else, but kind of looking at the big picture and going back and talking to their management, and then come back and talking to us and then doing some more planning, this is what they came up with. We're running TMG on both sides. We're using Cisco ACE. You know, the interesting thing about Cisco ACEs, they're going away, right? Everybody know that? So that raises, it to me, another little planning item. What do you do when the hardware that you're using or the software that you're using gets summarily punted out of the door by the manufacturer? What's your plan for carrying forward in that scenario? This is that domain. A little bit different look. They liked it sideways instead of vertical with the pretty arrows and pictures. And this right here is the South Africa setup. It's interesting to flip back and forth between the two because one of them looks kind of complicated. And you'll notice that we're running double, double, double on the edges. And when we get to here, it starts going single, single, single. However, for planning purposes, this right here was constructed as a pool. So when the time comes, they can just add IPs and add a server to the pool and they with no loss of continuity while they're doing the deployment. Which might be another consideration for you is if you start with singles, are you prepared to move to a DNSSB structure if at a later time HA is called for? For the back side of this over here, to go to HA, they're going to have to put another pool in place, move all the users over to it, move the RGSs over, move the call park service over, just move everything over, and then decom the first server. Takeaways for this. I think I've gone over it about 900 times, but I'll go over it again. Plan, 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 plan. If you, what's the famous phrase? If you don't plan for success, you're planning to fail. If you don't plan all this junk out ahead of time, in my experience, you'll be going back over it again, trying to find the maybe one or two things you skipped on or you didn't hit quite right. You got a typo in there somewhere. Something's not going to go right, and you're going to start burning hours, maybe a lot of them, trying to find your error or find out why something's not pointing in the right place. Business requirements, I think we should be started with. Network changes and access modalities change things radically. Who here has an iPhone? All right, I got an iPhone in my pocket. Droids, iPads, Windows 8, every single one of those needs, at times, a little bit different. Who runs Link Phone Edition for Enterprise Voice? So Link Phone Edition would be another reason why you can't do wildcards on a server. The 2010 versions simply don't like it. If you got all 2013s, like a CX600 with the very latest rev or something like that, they'll be okay with the wildcard, but if you have anything older, they won't be. All these little things need to be considered when we start talking about all this stuff, and if you don't plan for it, it's going to fail you. Sites, this last one down here, can't emphasize it enough. Take a look at your WAN links. Take a look at your firewalls. How's your route in? How's your route over? What's our bandwidth consumption today? What's the potential bandwidth for tomorrow? What's our projected usage loads? How's that going to affect our WAN link? How might that affect, heck, the primary WAN link out to the world, let alone the circuit over? How many people, hopefully nobody in this room, think that just because they've got a big fat WAN link leading to the world, that the MPLS link to their other site is going on a different circuit? You'd be surprised the people that go, oh, I have two of those. And it's like, no, it's running out the same firewall. You have a firewall, and that's your internet link, and then the MPLS comes off of that to somewhere else. And they go, no, it doesn't. I've got a separate little thing. And they go, so show it to me. And they go, here it is. And they got a single firewall sitting there. It's like, well, guys, here's the reality of the situation. The salesman said yes, 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 and this is what was delivered, something completely different. All right. Let me make sure that this thing is working. I want to show you this only because I find it to be fascinating. Might not be to everybody. This is the DNS chart. Nope, it's not. This is the cert chart for that New York, New Jersey layout I was talking about. And if I make it go to iChart size, you start talking about certs in various locations. This is why a wildcard cert might be handy. Might not work in all scenarios, but it's something to consider. And the cost structure just for these external website links that are right here in the middle here underneath that green line, where I've got 14 entries on a SAN list. Maybe at that point, the wildcard cert might make a really good idea. I have no idea how much they paid for these certs, but this is what they chose to do after doing their cost analysis. They chose this route here. And I think they bought 5-year certs too, so it's like, ooh, somebody spent some money on that one. DNS external, it's another eye chart if I crank it down, but it's another example of, let's plan this thing out a little bit and make sure that all these numbers match up, because I've got SRV records to consider, I've got FQDNs to consider, I've got external link web accesses, addresses to consider, I've got meet, I got dial-in, maybe I want to go link method number 2, which is use a common domain name, /meet/dial-in kind of thing. And if I'm going to go that route, maybe I might want to have simple URLs per site that might want to have their own DNS entry so people can find them, that kind of thing. So their external, for that project, the external DNS list ran, not too bad, 44 lines. DNS internals, the same argument. We'll look at how many lines it is real quick. 88 lines of nothing but FQDNs and IPs for that project. So clearly, if I had gone into this project and tried to wing it, I probably would have made at least one error somewhere along the line. And I see this as a primary planning tool for every project that I do, is I create these lists out, even for a really simple project. Maybe it's a single server, single edge, so I'm only going to be consuming maybe 4 IPs on the outside and 1 on the inside with maybe a couple for the edge, maybe a NAT. So maybe I've got maybe 10 IPs I'm working with total. But I still make these charts up because while it might only be 10 IPs, maybe they got 20 SIP domains, which all of a sudden blows my external list right out of the water. And if you don't think about it ahead of time, you'll be typing along going, geez, where was I at? Who approved this? Which is the other thing. Always get your stakeholders to approve before you start, even if it takes forever to get the approval. So that runs 88 lines down the list. Quite fun. Here's the DNS and IP, DNS FQDN IP chart that I put together for each project. And it runs down the list considerably. It's a couple blank lines in there. 3 separate domains, 110 lines, not too bad. I list every server, every FQDN, every alias, every SQL server, every file share. Everything should get listed on a piece of paper before you start. All right, so that's what I got. We've got a couple of admin items. Please fill out the evaluation form for the session. Apparently, some of us yesterday neglected to ask for that. And we got a little piece of email this morning saying, hey, no one ever did that. They tossed a bunch of slides in. There's an attendee party tonight. Everybody's going, right? Except me. I'm going out to dinner with my wife. Hands-on labs. Nice. Is everybody taking advantage of those? I know you are. You're no fun. Up on my link, we've got a variety of wild stuff. I think we quit on Thursday, I think, 48 hours. So sometime probably Monday morning, every session in the world that ran here today will be available to you for download. And you might want to go to the Tuesday version of this because it was different from day to day because I hardly ever say the same thing twice. And fill out evaluations and win prizes. So, I've got, speaking of that, how am I doing on time here? Oh, look at that. So I got a couple of cards here. How about somebody, first person to tell me what I think the primary planning consideration is for a link project?
Business requirements.
I made a statement that I think 100% of the time issues that come up are due to what? Nicely done. By the way, I asked that question for a reason, because literally 100% of the projects that I'm on that we start having trouble with, it's networks and firewalls. It's either the VLAN construction, people didn't know what they were doing, the firewall's not right. A couple of times, and I'll be honest about it, I gave them the chart of what to do for their firewall, and I had a typo in it. And we were dealing with a third-party support out of India, and bless his soul, when we went and did the little screen share so he could show us what he did, there's a typo staring us in the face, and I'm going, oh, you got that wrong. And about the time I said that on my screen, I was scrolling through my preparation doc, and guess what? There was a typo. And it's like, oh, but still, it was networks and firewalls. We don't know where the network and firewall problem came from. In this case, it was my own typo that he faithfully reproduced, but still, it was a network firewall issue. All right. When did I start doing this? I mentioned it right up front. When did I start focusing on Microsoft? I'm sorry? All right. I don't know if it was keynote or not, but there was an announcement made about SQL and 2013 made just the other day. Anybody know what it is? I'm sorry? That's okay. You can give it away to somebody else. You can't give it to him. Okay, one last one. Do I need to deploy portions or all of Enterprise Voice to get dial-in conferencing? You already got a card. Anybody? You don't know for sure? The answer is you have to lease part of it to get dial-in conferencing. Maybe not the full, everybody enabled for it with all, all your IPs laid out and all your TeleURIs laid out, but you're going to need a portion of Enterprise Voice to do dial-in conferencing.
Just the binaries.
I'm sorry?
Just the binaries.
Oh, the binaries. For 100% of my deployments, I always click on all them buttons anyway for a pool. So when the client asks for it later, and they will, I can turn. It's already turned on. I don't have to go back and do it again. What you're going to need is at least one voice policy. You're going to need to have some methodology of getting the PSTN lines into your system. That's what I mean by you're going to have to at least do part of Enterprise Voice. Dial-in conferencing. I've never done, by the way, conferencing without putting dial-in conferencing in place, either with a SIP trunk or through some sort of gateway. Do I recognize you from last year? You weren't in San Diego last year?
I wasn't.
Then your brother was.
It might have been.
Might have been. Okay.
Your brother might have made it.
Yes, sir?
Could you talk a little bit about your decision not to deploy a dedicated director?
So a director, its purpose in life out of the LCS 2005 days, was to give you a security abstraction next hop landing zone to offload authentication chores from the front end pool where it's going to happen anyway. So way back then, I didn't really see the need for one because I was doing a bunch of smaller deployments, and the director was kind of aimed at that time frame at the enterprise pool, let's offload the authentication. As we get into the R2 and R1 days, the same kind of thing held. We got this director layer that's supposedly protecting the inside system from a DDoS attack or maybe a brute force kind of thing. And that's all it's ever really been there for. But you're already abstracted off by the edge server. You're already abstracted off by a layer of firewalls, possibly two or three of them. And I've never really seen the need for it. And so it's always been optional anyway. Most of my customers didn't want to pay the expense of it. At the time, it was a completely separate licensing issue. So to put up a director, they had to license the server at the OS level, buy the hardware, buy the OCS or Link or LCS license. With Link 2010, it became a bit easier because one license covers everything except for the front end. But they still weren't doing it. I give it out as an option for each client that I work with. I try to explain to them what it does. We show them, how it would fit in. And then I let them choose. And across the board, they all say no to it. Maybe because I'm going, director. Something like that. But still, my job as a consultant is not to tell them what to do. My job is to help them make a choice based on all the little moving parts that they've got. Does that answer your question or not?
Yeah, it does. I think, I mean, we have an F5 in place, and you know that should catch a lot of authentication attempts from the same IP address.
Right. So are you using an F5 with all three modalities engaged on it?
Yes.
Yeah, so you've got a firewall sitting there.
Yeah.
You've got a stateful inspection occurring,
mm-hmm.
and you've got a NAT, and you've got a PAT going.
Mm-hmm.
I know a script kiddie can break through it, but what are you trying to protect? What time are you on? Oh, okay. You just came in here to make me nervous. Everybody know who Thomas Bender is?
Yeah.
He was in the first MCM class. I participated in writing the first MCM class when it was R2. My job was to put together the exchange modules. I worked with Doug Lottie on that, and he was sitting in the back, already famous MCM. This is a great resource. Okay, so any other questions? We got a couple minutes.
You showed yourself advocate scenario
there. Yeah?
Did you
pair, by the way, you tried to answer that one question very well.
Did you pair those every calls as well? Or did you not bother?
Oh, that South Africa solution was a... Yeah, that's everything in South Africa was singled. But we set up for, on the edge, a pool. Yeah. I mean, we tried to talk him into it, but South Africa was footing part of the bill. They were having to pay for the servers in the VM space. And at the time, we couldn't make it work. By the way, I forgot about that whole, that's a whole angle for planning, folks. How much sand space does this stuff take? If you're doing virtuals, by the way. On Monday, I come back here to Vegas to start a new project. It'll be the first physical server deployment for Link, and maybe even back into the OCS days that I've done. I've done just 100% virtuals. And on Monday, I'm starting a project where I know they've already bought hardware servers with DAS. And it's like, really? Okay, I can deal with that. So that's a great question. And I would say no to my experience. But when I'm involved in a project, when we get to that virtualization question, I just hammer them on what's the concurrency, what's our projected usage load, how much of your host. So if you've got a B-series UCS, for instance, a Cisco UCS, and you've got 24 cores and 128 gigs on it. I'm just kind of, let's load it up. But you've already got 40 other servers running there. Is that a good candidate to put a Link server onto? Well, the answer is no, but guess what they're going to try to do? Well, we really only need 2 gigs and 2 cores because we already know that's just going to be, it's like, well, okay. If that's the case, in my design document, I outline what they did, what we talked about, what I recommended, what the book says, and what they chose. And right above it, there's a big banner that says, this is deviating from Microsoft practices and CDW best practice recommendations, which were the customer chose this. So that later, when it doesn't work right, I get to go back to them and say, you approved this design.
That's why when they told me I had to go virtual or exchange it early,
mm-hmm.
I said, I'll only do it if I get dedicated virtual.
But you're in healthcare.
There's money to spend.
Well, yeah.
Never had any money to spend.
Everybody knows healthcare in the United States is $1 in every 6, right?
Yeah, that's why when I said for exchange, I needed 72 terabytes.
Oh man, I can't even. I don't even want to hear about it.
They said, okay. And that was it.
Any other questions on Link? What we talked about here? Any other general questions on Link? I might be able to answer. I already mentioned that. Yeah, and I mentioned that earlier, because I didn't know about it yesterday until after I was talking. So it's like, oh, come on, I need to know this stuff ahead of time. Any other questions? I mean, I'd be willing to pitch it open until the next session shows up, if one's coming in, on anything, Link.
How about running your equals for the DMZ itself? So this is completely off topic from what we've been discussing.
using a front-end pool in the DMZ? So I see you running into firewall hell.
Yeah, we know that.
And once you figure that out, it would work just fine. So it also would become an issue of what you've just created as a resource forest layout, which is fully supported by Link. So it would work. I don't think that's a proper question, because it's not a matter of does Microsoft support it, you know, in its own little DMZ. What you've just described is a resource forest and a resource domain, which is supported. So it doesn't really matter where it logically or physically sits inside of your structure. The fact is you created this resource forest, resource domain, component level layout and architecture, which is completely supported. I don't think I would do that. I did a university fairly major in Kansas, which is all of two to choose from. They had all public IPs, and every subnet was firewalled from every subnet. That's what I said, okay? And they had it down to, they were allowing 135, 445, 446, you know, the AD stuff. They allowed 80, 443, and some of the more, only what they needed to go through. And when I handed them the client chart for Link, they went, huh? Because they were going to have to approach somewhere in the neighborhood of 5,000 or 6,000 subnets and modify them all, which they scripted, and the guy got through it, but they had to do that. So I think you'd be in the same boat for planning purposes. That might put you away from what you were thinking about doing. You know, information security guys, they're there to make you do your job safely, not deny you the ability to work.
And how about one more question? So TNG products, as it's moving away, and you said when you've done all your implementations using TNG, so noting that obviously that's...
Obviously haven't been able to do that since last year, that's correct.
Right, so what have you been using as a replacement to what you've been using?
I'm a Kemp fanatic. Kemp? Load balancer fanatic, from the word get go. It does content redirect, and it's a load balancer. I don't care what the manufacturer is a reverse proxy by definition. But you're just not going to get maybe stateful inspection out of it. You're not going to get some security features out of it. But it will stop the traffic. I wrote a blog article on proving that here comes the traffic. It stops right here, and here you can see the load balancer requesting off information off the front end. And here's the front end via Netmon only talking back to the load balancer. So you can prove in packet tracing that the traffic's going like this, which makes it a reverse proxy. So it fills that role, and it fulfills the requirements of a reverse proxy while not having the moniker, I'm a reverse proxy. And then if you need content redirect, that it'll do that also. Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. The Kemp, the extended security pack on a Kemp does not handle Link in any way, shape, or form. Yeah, it doesn't do that. Nice seeing you again. Yeah, that's okay. Oh, nice. Time up. But and I need to talk to you about that, by the way. Any other questions? If not, I think we're done. And it looks like the next speaker is here.